Good afternoon, and everyone, and welcome to Tushita, and welcome to this Heart Sutra course. My name's Glenn Svensson, and together with Jonas, we'll be leading this program. I'll be focusing on the classroom sessions, and Jonas will be leading the meditations. Maybe we just cover a few logistics before we launch in to the course. Just to go through the schedule again, I think most of you are fairly familiar. It's posted on the door here and over near the dining room, I think. So today there's like two introductory sessions. There's one now till 4:30, then half hour break, and 5 to 6 again, another sort of follow on introductory session with me here. And then 6 o'clock will be dinner, and then this evening you'll start the meditation sessions with Jonas at 7:30. And then tomorrow for the next 7 days we have the same schedule every day, and that is 6:45 in the morning with Jonas. You'll be doing meditation till 7:30 for breakfast. And then in the morning there's going to be two teaching sessions with me. The first one 9 till 10:15. Then we have a half hour morning tea break, and then 10:45 till 11:45 the second session, and then 11:45 will be lunch. So we're staggering the meals because there's another course here with 80 people in it, so we're staggering it so that actually we sort of get in before them. Not being selfish, but logistically it works better that way. So in the morning time at breakfast, your session will be finished at 7:30, and they'll be finishing a little bit, only about 5 minutes after that. So you should go straight to the breakfast at 7:30. And then lunchtime, again, is 11:45. They'll be having lunch at 12 o'clock. Afternoon sessions, 2 till 3 will be the first afternoon teaching session. 3 to 3:30 is afternoon tea break. And then 3:30 till 4:45 is the second afternoon teaching session here. And then again another half an hour break. And then at 5:15 there'll be a meditation with Jonas till 6. So you'll be getting dinner at 6 o'clock. The other group will be at 6:15. And then in the evening again 7:30 till 8:15, another meditation with Jonas. So that's the same schedule tomorrow for the next 7 days. And then on the last morning of the course, again the morning meditation at 6:45 with Jonas, and then he'll also be giving you some meditation advice in that session. And then after breakfast at 9 o'clock Kumpen will be giving a wrap up and a feedback round for an hour or so, and then a short break, and then from 10:30 till probably 11:30 or 12 I'll be giving the last session, a little bit of summary and also a little bit of advice about the Heart Sutra and how to take it into our, integrate it into our daily life. So that's the, and then of course 12 o'clock is picnic lunch and then we're finished. So that's the schedule. Again, it's on the door here. Most sessions, the start will be the same as the other group, so there'll be gong going. So you just listen for the gongs. There'll be two sessions where there's no gong, and that will be in the morning, the morning tea break. There won't be a gong, so I'll just remind you tomorrow that you'll have to keep your eye on the watch and get back in time for the second morning session. And also in the afternoon, the meditation with Jonas at 5:15, there will be no gong for that. So they're the two times where you'll have to keep an eye on the watch, but we'll remind you again tomorrow. Course material, you should all have two things there. Got the Heart Sutra with lots of extras in there. So very briefly, on the first two pages we've got the Heart Sutra, but what you'll probably notice there is that there's a lot of outlines that I've put in there, and that's from a latter Tibetan commentary on the Heart Sutra, and I've put those in there just to see how the Heart Sutra can be divided up And that's more or less the same structure that we'll be using in this course to go through the Heart Sutra. So we'll be, each day we'll be reciting the Heart Sutra. So that's for there. And then if you go to the next page, you see a little mind map here which shows the structure of the Heart Sutra that we're going to be following. And then we got what's called the Mahayana path, which is the spiritual path to enlightenment. And we'll be referring to that quite a lot in this course, and looking at the Heart Sutra in terms of how to progress along these various stages of this Mahayana path to enlightenment. And then after that we have a number of charts that we'll be referring from time to time. Also in the middle here we have the shamatha diagram. We'll be talking a little bit about the shamatha practice, because the emptiness practice becomes more effective if we have a good basis in the shamatha practice, so we'll be spending a little bit of time on that partway through the course. And at the end, the last two pages, we have this wheel of life, which also comes up in the Heart Sutra, and I'll be explaining a little bit more about this later in the course. So that's the material. You also have this book here called Virtue and Reality, which covers, as it says here, method and wisdom in the practice of Dharma. So the two aspects of the practice of compassion and wisdom. And so the wisdom part here, of course, is all about emptiness. Also, there's a little bit about these the Mahayana path in here as well. And also we're going to be touching on briefly the compassion side of the practice in terms of bodhicitta. So this could be some useful material there. So in your spare time during the course, if you'd like to read a little bit from this book, of course this is for you to keep. You may find some relevant information in there related to our course. So that's the material for the course. Also, I'll be, during the course, referring to a number of books, in particular The Essence of the Heart Sutra from His Holiness Dalai Lama. So I'll be reading from that a few times during the course, and also a couple of other books that I'll be quoting from time to time as well. Okay, just that's on logistics. Anything about the logistics of the course, the schedule, or anything that's not clear? I think everything's more or less been explained, hopefully. Okay. So just a little bit on how to approach these coming days. I think it's important to have a nice relaxed approach in this course, because as a few of you have already mentioned, this topic of emptiness is quite profound, quite difficult to understand. So if we have this expectation that by the end of this course we'll have quite a good understanding of emptiness, I think we may find we're going to get a little bit frustrated in this course. So rather just keep an open mind, and of course try and pick up as much as you can in the course. What you pick up, be happy with that. What you don't understand, then of course the next time you read about it or listen to it or reflect on it, you may pick up a little bit more. So this topic in particular is something I think we'll need to hear, reflect and meditate on many, many, many times before we really get a good appreciation of it. And of course we are trying to develop wisdom, and we can talk about three wisdoms. The first wisdom, of course, is the wisdom of hearing, where we listen to some instruction about the topic. This also, of course, includes reading books, so we're getting some information from an outside source. So here, regarding this, then One piece of advice is, I like, for those of you who've done courses with me, you know that well, I like classes to be very interactive. So if you have any questions, meaning if you don't understand what I'm saying, then please ask questions. But raise your hand, and then often I'll acknowledge that you want to ask a question, and I'll wait till I've sort of finished the point, and then I'll ask, get you to ask the question. With asking questions, please keep the question to the topic, otherwise it's easy to get sort of distracted in all sorts of interesting things, but then we can't really focus on what we're trying to do here. So this is the first wisdom we're trying to develop, the wisdom of hearing. Then we're trying to develop the wisdom of contemplation, which of course is to think about the things that we've heard. So here, what I can recommend is to not just blindly accept anything I tell you, because that's not going to help. What you need to do is think about the things that I'm explaining and see if they make sense to you, whether they match your experience, and to really contemplate these points. Now, with this, it's very good to think about or to review things that we've heard often and quickly, because modern studies have shown that if you don't think about or review the things that you've heard within 24 hours, then you forget 75% of everything you've heard. So we're going to try to avoid that in this course. What I'm planning to do is each morning in the 9 o'clock session, I want to start with a short meditation, but then I want to review what we've covered in the previous day to refresh ourselves so we don't forget that before we move on. Also, what I'm planning to do is in the last teaching session each afternoon at 3:30, I want to do a sort of review of the Heart Sutra itself, but in the form of what's called a glance meditation. So I'll be sort of leading you through a meditation, and I'll just be reading the Heart Sutra, and then from time to time I'll stop at a point and explain a little bit more, and then we can reflect on that. So in that session we're trying to just really become familiar with the Heart Sutra, the words and the meaning of those. So we'll be doing that each afternoon in the fourth session, teaching session. So with these two points, of course, we can get a good intellectual understanding. But of course, merely gaining an intellectual understanding is not enough, because the whole point of this topic of emptiness is basically to come to realize the nature of reality. Because the Buddhist assertion is that it's our misunderstanding of how we exist and how the world around us exists that is the root source of all of our suffering. And merely gaining some intellectual understanding of the nature of reality is not really going to change much, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding, it's driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit is to instinctively see ourselves and the world in a wrong way. So what we need to do, of course, is to change that habit. And so to do that, what we need to do, of course, is to bring our intellectual understanding into experience. And the best way to do that, of course, is through meditation. That by meditating on these points that we are looking at, reflecting on, we will internalize our understanding, and we'll bring our intellectual understanding of emptiness into experience through meditation. And that will then, of course, transform our mind, and that will work against our wrong way of seeing ourselves and the world. So, of course, we are going to be covering all of these three things in this course, and with the meditation, of course, Jonas will be leading you through various meditations each day. Also, I will be leading a short meditation in the morning and in the afternoon as well. So when we talk about the spiritual path or spiritual practice, we can talk about two main aspects. Sometimes they're called the two wings of the practice. And in Sanskrit, that is prajna and upaya. Prajna is wisdom, and upaya is method, normally translated as method. And here method, of course, is talking about our behavior, our activities. And all of our activities should be based on a good motivation, the motivation of compassion. So sometimes this wing is simply called the compassion wing for that reason. So the two aspects of the practice is wisdom and compassion. Now, of course, the Heart Sutra is mainly talking about the wisdom wing. But of course, we need to make sure that we don't forget the compassion wing. As we're going to see tomorrow, we're going to see very shortly, is that if we don't balance our practice with both these aspects, we can end up in not a very healthy place. Now, within the Buddhist spiritual path, we can talk about these wisdom and compassion practices at a number of levels. And when Buddhism first spread from India, it originally spread through two languages, Pali and Sanskrit. When Buddhism spread from India through the Pali language, then all those traditions based on the Pali language are now referred to as the Theravada traditions. And when we look in those traditions, and of course this includes things like Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese, Cambodian, Laos, Thailand. In these traditions, when we look at this upaya wing of the practice, the compassion wing of the practice, then often this is presented as what's called the four immeasurables. And within the Pali tradition, these four immeasurables are often referred to as the four Brahma Viharas. And vihara often translated as like abode. So sometimes these are called like the four abodes of Brahma, meaning that by doing these practices we can end up in these sort of types of existences. But also it's called the four immeasurables, and I'll have a look at them very shortly, what they are. In the wisdom wing of the practice within the Theravada Pali traditions, usually this is presented as the three marks of existence. And these are three things that we are trying to develop. Now, in the wisdom wing of the practice, then this wisdom wing of the practice in Pali, often the Pali word used to describe to use for wisdom practice is, of course, vipassana. So when we talk about vipassana practice, we're talking about the wisdom practice. The VI means higher or beyond, and passana means to see. So vipassana practice means to see beyond or higher seeing. Usually this is translated into English as either insight or special insight, meaning wisdom. So often the wisdom practice is simply called vipassana practice. So within the Pali traditions, the Theravada traditions, when they talk about vipassana practice, normally they're talking about coming to realize these three things, the three marks of existence, which is to realize impermanence, or in Pali, of course, that is anicca, and the second thing we're trying to realize is, and of course impermanence here means that things are changing from moment to moment, momentary change. The second thing is dukkha. Of course, dukkha is the Buddha's diagnosis for what condition we find ourselves in, this unsatisfactory state, often translated as suffering, but that can be a little bit misleading. So this is the second insight we're trying to develop, is the insight into the state we find ourselves in now. And the third insight is this wisdom of no self, or in Pali, anatta. That there is no self. Now, of course, what that means, we're going to talk a lot about later, just to mention it here. So, when we talk about the wisdom practice or the vipassana practice within the Theravada traditions, these are the things that we are trying to come to realize: impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And we'll be looking at those in more detail probably, I think, tomorrow. So just to briefly mention them here. Now, if we go to the traditions which came through the Sanskrit language, Sanskrit traditions now these days are usually called the Mahayana traditions, and this includes traditions such as Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Korean, Vietnamese, Tibetan, Mongolian. These traditions were transmitted through the Sanskrit language. And here, when we talk about the compassion wing of practice, then we usually are referring to this aspiration called bodhicitta. Bodhi, of course, means enlightenment. Citta is mind. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. It's the mind which aspires to enlightenment in order to help liberate everyone else from suffering as well. Now, this compassion wing of the practice here is based on these four immeasurables. And these four immeasurables practices are loving kindness, which in Sanskrit is maitri, in Pali it's metta. And loving kindness, of course, is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. And here, the word immeasurable is referring to the fact that we're trying to develop these qualities towards immeasurable sentient beings. Means towards all sentient beings. So immeasurable loving kindness is the wish for all sentient beings to have happiness and its causes. Compassion in Pali and Sanskrit is karuna, and compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. So of course immeasurable compassion is the wish for all sentient beings to be free of suffering and its causes. The third of the four immeasurables is empathetic joy, or mudita in Sanskrit and Pali. Empathetic joy is rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and happiness. So this is a very good antidote for jealousy, because usually when we see other people having good things, we become jealous of them. So immeasurable empathetic joy is usually described as the wish for all sentient beings never to be separated from their happiness. And it's really a rejoicing in our own and others' happiness and virtuous actions. And the fourth of the four immeasurables is equanimity. In Sanskrit, upeksha, in Pali, upekkha. And equanimity here is this sort of impartial attitude towards others. Normally our attitude towards others is very biased, meaning our attitude towards others is usually reflected in terms of how others affect me and my happiness, which means that we tend to have a lot of attachment to our friends because they seem to support me and my happiness. Towards strangers, we tend to be often very apathetic and indifferent because they don't seem to affect me and my happiness in any way. And then we often get very hostile, maybe have a lot of anger and hatred towards the difficult people, the so-called enemy, because they seem to be interfering with me and my happiness. So we have this very unbalanced and biased attitude towards others, depending on how they seem to affect me and my happiness. Equanimity is about overcoming this bias, and it's a sense of closeness to everyone, because we can understand that everyone is just like us in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. And so this equanimity is this sense of closeness to everyone in that way. So these four measurables are the basis of the compassion wing here in the Theravada tradition, and then that is the basis for going on to developing bodhicitta within the Mahayana or Sanskrit traditions. And we'll be looking at this bodhicitta in a little bit more detail tomorrow. So then if we come over to the wisdom wing in the Sanskrit tradition, and of course wisdom in Sanskrit, instead of vipassana, often the word that's used is vipassana. So vipassana, so often within the Sanskrit traditions, when we talk about wisdom practice, we talk about vipassana practice, like vipassana in the Pali. Now, here in the Mahayana, the Sanskrit traditions, when we talk about the wisdom practice or the vipassana practice, then the main practice, the main wisdom practice that we're talking about, of course, is this wisdom of emptiness. In Sanskrit is shunyata. So of course emptiness here is talking about the nature of reality, how things exist, the fact that everything is empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently. There's no independent me, no independent objective world. So this is emptiness. And so of course this is the topic for the Heart Sutra. So within the Heart Sutra, of course, we're going to be looking mainly at this. But of course, remember, this is based on this. And if we understand these three marks of existence, then through understanding them and reflecting and meditating on these, that can be a very good basis for emptiness practice. Because this emptiness is very subtle, very difficult to appreciate. Even this wisdom of impermanence can be very helpful. Of course, now we all intellectually understand this. We learned it at school, science has proven it. I think we all have no problem in accepting this idea at an intellectual level. But is our intellectual understanding of impermanence, is that somehow helping us much in our daily life? Not so much. But if we were to meditate on impermanence and come to taste it, to experience it in meditation, thereby experientially see that everything around us is in this constant state of change and flow, that would have a dramatic, immediate improvement in our life. And also, that realization of impermanence is not so different than the wisdom of emptiness. If we really can realize impermanence, we are at a very good level to come then to work on the emptiness practice. So not only will this experience and realization have a dramatic positive impact in our life, but it would also be a very solid basis for working on the wisdom of emptiness. And also this insight into dukkha is very helpful for our emptiness practice, because this realization of dukkha is what will inspire us to break free of this cycle, this state we find ourselves in now. Because now we tend to be looking for happiness out there, and we put a lot of time and effort into trying to find the happiness out there, particularly in terms of pleasure, pleasant experiences. But if we come to realize this, then not only will we realize there's no genuine happiness to be found out there, and thereby give up or chasing after all these pleasures, thereby opening up a lot of time and energy to devote to ourselves in a more meaningful way, but we will also then understand from this that the source of happiness and suffering is within, and we'll develop the aspiration to strive for liberation from suffering. And so that's going to be very helpful as a basis for the emptiness practice. And then, of course, coming to realize no self is also going to be a very good basis for the emptiness practice. Now, here, the word self, we have to be very careful about this word. And it's used in two different ways within Buddhist texts. When we speak very generally in a conventional way, and we're talking about, particularly in the area of four immeasurables and bodhicitta, we talk about, you know, self and others. There, the word self just means me versus others. So, of course, then there is self in terms of there is me and there are others. But there we're not talking about how I exist. We're just using the word self to refer to myself as opposed to other people. So that just means person. So that's fine. Whereas here, in Vipassana or Vipassana practice, when we use the word self, we're talking about how do I exist. So there the word self is used to refer to a particular way in which we believe we exist. And it's a sort of in an overinflated, solid way. So here the word self is that. It's talking about this sort of overinflated sense of me. So in that way, when we're talking in this context, there is no self, because it's an overinflated sense of me. So we have to be careful about this distinction in these two contexts, how that word self is used. Because otherwise we get a lot of confusion, where we see here there's no self, yet in this context we're talking about self versus others. So how can we talk about self versus others when we say there's no self? And then there's a lot of confusion. So that's how to know, is when we see the word self in a Buddhist text, we have to look at what is the context that this word is being used in. Is it being used in a discussion about the nature of reality? If so, then no self, because that's talking about an overinflated sense of me. If the word self is used in a context of simply talking about self versus others, then of course there is self, because self is just me. We're not talking about how I exist in that context. So if we really come to realize this no self, this would also be a very good basis for our emptiness practice. It would really be a strong platform for that. So with Jonas in the meditations, you're going to be one more point is that as a basis of this practice, in fact, as a basis of any practice, if we want any practice to be effective, we need a very stable, clear, focused mind. We know from our own experience that, you know, we try to meditate on certain things and our mind is completely distracted and dull and nothing much happens. They're not very effective. And so actually, within the spiritual path, as we're going to see in the coming sessions, we can talk about three core areas of practice, and two things which are of those three which are very supportive of the basis of this Vipassana practice. We can talk about what's called the three higher trainings. And these are the three sort of core areas of the practice, whether we're talking at the Pali or the Mahayana level, the Theravada or Mahayana level. And the basis, of course, is ethics. So if we want any practice to be effective, we need to have, of course, an ethical foundation to our lifestyle. Then we need to, of course, have a concentrated mind. So the concentration practice, we need to have a stable, clear, focused mind. Because without that, then none of our Vipassana practice, bodhicitta, four immeasurables practices, none of these practices are going to penetrate very much. We're not going to be able to bring our intellectual understanding into experience in the meditation, because our mind will be distracted and dull. We're not going to be able to penetrate these topics. So therefore we need to have a concentration practice. And in the spiritual path, in the Buddhist spiritual path, we can develop many levels of concentration. The particular level of concentration we're trying to develop is called shamatha. And shamatha is usually often translated into English as calm abiding. And so if we want any of our Vipassana practices or any of the other practices to be effective, we need to put some effort into the shamatha practice. And then, of course, the wisdom practice is the Vipassana practice. So, with that in mind, what we're going to be doing in this course is the morning meditations with Jonas. You'll be working on the shamatha practice, working on developing that stable, clear, focused mind as the basis for the Vipassana practice. And in particular, in the shamatha practice, you will be... within that shamatha practice, you can focus on different types of objects And of course, the one that's usually most widely recommended in most Buddhist traditions is to focus on the breath. And for the first couple of days, you'll do that with Jonas. But then for the rest of the course, we're going to move into a little bit more subtle area, and that is to focus on the mind, to use the mind as the object. There are a lot of benefits with that, which I'll talk about a little bit later in the course. But also in particular, by focusing on the mind, that style of shamatha practice is a very good bridge into the vipassana practice, particularly in coming to realize the nature of the mind. So that's why we're going to focus quite a lot in the shamatha practice using the mind as the object. It can be very... One, there are a lot of immediate benefit, direct benefits, and two, it's a very good bridge into the vipassana practice. So that's the morning sessions before breakfast. In the afternoon sessions, the 5:15 session, you'll be doing the vipassana practice with Jonas. Again, the first few days we'll work on the basis, impermanence, dukkha and no self, to work on those as the basis, and then moving to more emptiness meditations as we progress through the course in those afternoon sessions. But again, we need to make sure that our wisdom practice is balanced with the compassion wing. And so in the evening session with Jonas, you'll be focusing on the compassion wing through the four immeasurables and various bodhicitta style practices. So that's going to be the evening sessions. I will also be leading in the 9 o'clock session, I'll be leading a short vipassana meditation as well. And also, as I mentioned, in the afternoon at 3:30, we'll be doing that little meditation on the Heart Sutra directly. So that's also going to be a little bit of a vipassana meditation as well, but I'll be leading at 3:30. So we're going to be doing quite a lot in the vipassana area in this course. One more point before we can go for a break, and that is, again, we need to make sure that we have both wings of practice, wisdom and compassion. Unfortunately, many people who enter into the spiritual path tend to sort of gravitate to one or the other, depending on their personal preference, and sort of forget about the other side. And then usually end up in not a very good space, not a good place. For example, you know, since the vipassana practice is what's going to really overcome our ignorance and suffering, a lot of people put effort into vipassana practice. But then they sort of forget about the compassion side of it. And unfortunately, what happens often when this is the case, then a vipassana meditator often becomes very self-absorbed in their practice, and they become very disconnected from the world, and they often become very insensitive to the sufferings of others. And then often, if someone sort of disturbs their little vipassana practice, they get very upset with them. And also sometimes people think that because there's some high-level vipassana practitioner, that they've sort of gone beyond this ethics, that, you know, this ethics stuff, that's just for beginners. But I'm a high-level vipassana practitioner now, so that doesn't apply to me. So I can do whatever I want. And, of course, it's a big mess. So this is an example of wisdom without the compassion wing, what can happen. But also, sometimes people really gravitate towards the compassion wing. And then they forget about the wisdom wing. And then, of course, that leads to some difficulties as well. For example, you know, we can have a lot of compassion, but our compassion can be very biased. Yes, I'll help these people because they're nice people, they deserve to be helped. But these people, I'm not going to help them because they're nasty people. In fact, I hope they suffer because they're doing bad things. So this is, can be a little bit of bias in our compassion. But of course, even if we have the best intention in the world to help others, often we end up simply doing things that don't help, in fact often harm, because we don't know what we're doing. So this is an example of the compassion without the wisdom of understanding how to help people. And then of course what can happen as well is particularly people who have a lot of compassion, who want to really go out and fix and save the world and heal the world, and we see this sometimes in aid workers or social workers, is they go out full of enthusiasm and then often within 3 to 6 months compassion burnout, completely burnt out. And so this is another example of the compassion without the wisdom. Of course, here the wisdom wing would be the wisdom understanding what we can do to help, what we can't do to help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest and look after ourselves. And another thing, and this has probably happened to us, all of us, many times, is that we go to help someone and then they take advantage of us. And so, again, that is an example of compassion without wisdom. Here the wisdom would be, of course, to not allow that person to take advantage of us. So these are some examples of how, if we just do the compassion wing and we forget about wisdom wing, how that can lead us to end up in not a very good place. So whatever, I think, spiritual path we're following, we need to make sure we have both of these practices together, wisdom and compassion, to have them balanced. And so that's what we're going to be doing also in this course. Even though the Heart Sutra is, the topic of the Heart Sutra, of course, is primarily this, we are going to, in our Vipassana practice, of course, we're going to spend a bit of time on the bases. We're also going to balance that with the compassion wing in the evening. And then, of course, to make all of these practices effective, we're going to work on the shamatha practice in the morning session before breakfast. Okay. Any questions on that before we take a short break? So I've covered a few things, but again, all of these things I'm going to, of course, go into more detail. So I've just sort of briefly mentioned them there to make it clear to us. So anyone have any questions? Everything's super clear or super confused? Anything at all?
Nothing to do with this. I just wanted to ask, are we in silence?
Yeah, well, that was my next point. Okay. So, if there's, but before that, is there any questions on this? Which word in particular? Immeasurables? Yeah. I'm going to be going through all of these in more detail later. Okay. So in which word in particular? The word immeasurable?
And the 1 minute.
Yeah. Okay. These four, I've rubbed them out now, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. Those four practices, in the Mahayana, usually they're called the four immeasurables.
Immeasurable, this means...
Immeasurable, you can't measure.
Okay.
And it's referring to the number of sentient beings. Okay. That the number of sentient beings in the universe is like, we can't count, it's immeasurable. So that's what the word immeasurable means. It means those are four qualities we need to develop towards immeasurable sentient beings, means towards all sentient beings. In the Theravada tradition, normally these four practices are called the four Brahma Viharas, not the four immeasurables, it's just a different name.
Mm.
Brahma, a Vihara means like abode or place. And Brahma, within Buddhist tradition, is talking about a worldly god. You know, one of these, it's talking about within the Buddhist traditions, we can talk about the fact that we now live in what's called here the desire realm.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another higher plane of existence called the form realm.
Yeah.
It's a very high, subtle level of physical existence, form realm. Mm-hmm. And one of those areas in there is called the Brahma realm.
Okay.
So it's said that within Theravada, if you develop these qualities, you can end up mm-hmm. in that place, in the place of Brahma, in that form realm area.
To go to this world and not to the other way, huh?
Sorry?
What we were talking about is we prefer to go to this world and not to the other way.
Yeah, so that's how these are listed within the Theravada tradition, that if you develop them, you can end up in this very sort of subtle level of existence.
Okay.
But we're going to talk about that form realm in a little bit more detail later in the context of the shamatha practice. So I'll explain a little bit more about that later in the course.
So, prajna is also wisdom and vipassana is also wisdom. Like, what's the relation between prajna and vipassana?
Well, vipassana, prajna is normally translated as wisdom. Vipassana is normally translated as insight. Insight. So they're two very similar words, and usually in this context they are referring really to the same thing. I mean, again, the word vipassana or vipassana, the VI means higher, passana means to see, so it means to see beyond. So it's just another way of describing the same thing, I think. So here when we talk about the wisdom wing or the prajna wing, we can also equally, you just use the word vipassana practice or vipassana practice. Of course, when we talk about vipassana or vipassana practice, we can talk about many different types of insight. You know, often people say, oh, I'm doing vipassana practice. But then you'd have to ask them, well, what insight are you trying to get? You know, there's these three things, there's emptiness, there are other things as well. So this is a very general term, and within that, of course, we can gain many types of insight. You know? So we should, because often the thing is that many people see this word based on the Goenka course. They say 10-day Vipassana retreat. So when they hear the word Vipassana, they think, oh, that means scanning the body. Not really. Scanning the body is one technique used within the Burmese tradition that Goenka is based on, that's used particularly to come to realize impermanence. So it's just one technique to gain the insight of impermanence in particular. Okay, then back to the point here about silence. So yes, this course is going to be run in silence, and that will be, of course, for your own benefit. Of course, not total silence, because when you're in the class you have an opportunity to ask me questions, but outside of that, then the whole course is being run in silence. But I think so far you haven't really had a chance much to get to know each other, so now we've got a break, about 25 minute break now. So if you want to have a chat, that's fine, but remember there's the other course running, so there's a restriction. If you want to chat, only inside the dining room. So till 5 o'clock, if you want to have a chat inside the dining room. Outside you need to be silent, otherwise you'll disturb the other group. And then at 5 o'clock, then we go into the silent mode until the last morning of the course. Okay? Is that all clear? Okay. So let's take a break now. Have a tea break. And we'll come back at 5 o'clock, so there won't be a gong now. So you just have to keep your there's clocks around anyway. So 5 o'clock we'll come back. So again, if you want to have a chat, then that's okay, as long as you're inside the dining room. Okay, and then I'll see you at 5 o'clock.